Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Happy New Year to you all, and pleased to be here to talk to you today. Since we last met in August, the global economy has continued an expansion that began around the middle of 2009. It appears that world GDP grew at an annualised pace of about 4% in the second half of last year. Many forecasters now expect a similar result to that in 2010. International financial markets have generally continued to thaw, with most capital markets functioning again, and the use by large banks of exceptional support from central banks and government guarantees being wound down. These are, needless to say, very welcome developments. That said, I think some challenges do remain in the international situation, and I'll mention just two. The first of them is the two-speed nature of the global upswing. Now, normally after a sharp, large recession, the ensuing upturn was also typically quite sharp. That has been the case in a number of countries in the Asia-Pacific, which of course takes half of Australia's exports. That strength isn't confined to China. India, Korea, Singapore, Taiwan, some others have all seen a significant pickup in production and trade. In a number of these cases, the term V-shaped recovery would certainly be apt. In this region, secularly rising incomes, generally healthy banking systems, relatively low public debt levels, allow considerable room for confidence of a sustained expansion in demand. In fact, in some cases, overheating is becoming the issue, and as you probably know, the authorities in both China and India have begun to tighten their policy settings. In the large industrial countries, on the other hand, the rebound has been more tentative and more driven by the turn in the inventory cycle and temporary policy measures than a strong pickup in private demand. Now, it's not unusual at this point in the cycle for that to be the case, for the inventory dynamics to be prominent. Nonetheless, the question is the extent to which a durable upswing in private final demand will become established. Most observers still expect that to be a fairly gradual process, given the lingering effect of the strain on banking systems, ongoing deleveraging, not to mention the need at some point to begin the process of fiscal consolidation. Growth in those cases is therefore expected to remain modest, and as a result, these economies, the large industrial countries, are likely to be characterised by quite a lot of spare capacity, ongoing high unemployment. So the shift in the centre of economic gravity to the Asian region is continuing. And if anything, it's been highlighted by the different performances in the crisis and the initial recovery. The differences in speed of recovery between the emerging world and the advanced world, and the likely persistent differences in growth trajectories into the future, will, I think, increase the pressure on exchange rate arrangements in the Asian region. The second challenge internationally is the increasing focus on sovereign creditworthiness. We saw a brief period of turmoil regarding Dubai late last year, and more recently the public finances of Greece have been under the spotlight, with those of a few other European countries just in the background. Going just beyond those instances, government balance sheets in numerous countries have taken on considerable burdens as a result of the crisis, and markets are beginning to focus on issues of sustainability. It will be a very delicate balancing act for those countries, I think, to strengthen their fiscal positions without, of course, undermining the strength of the economic upswing they're seeing. Happily, in both these areas, Australia is relatively well placed. We're located in the part of the world that's seeing the most growth. And in terms of fiscal sustainability, Australia's position is, by any measure, very strong indeed. Turning then to Australia, we think on the basis of the data that's available thus far, that real GDP grew by about 2% through 2009, We expect it will grow a bit over 3% in 2010 and about 3.5% in 2011 and 12. What's driving that? Well, notwithstanding reports of patchy retail sales through the Christmas period, we judge consumption to have held up reasonably well after the various fiscal boosts faded. But in the future, I think consumption's unlikely to be the leading driver of growth in the way it was a few years ago. Households, I think, seem to be adopting a more cautious position regarding saving and borrowing, which is appropriate. A turnaround in private housing construction is underway. The effect of the temporary first home buyers boosts are fading, but underlying demand is solid as population growth is strong, and there's something of an underhang, so to speak, of earlier low construction to work off. That is, we weren't building enough dwellings for a couple of years. Credit costs and availability of credit are adequate for households. For developers, credit remains difficult to access, but it looks like we've seen a turning point now in approvals for multi-unit construction. Housing prices, as you know, have been rising quite smartly over the past year. Government spending is having an impact on demand, holding both residential and non-residential construction higher than it would have been based on private spending alone. This effect will gradually diminish over the next year. At the same time, a large build-up in energy and resource sector investment is underway, prompted by optimism about long-run prospects for resource demand. The terms of trade are rising again after last year's sharp fall, as the strength of demand has pushed up key commodity prices. In 2010, the terms of trade could once again reach a very high level, a level in fact exceeded in modern times only by the extraordinary level seen in 2008. Inflation has been falling in line with recent forecasts. Now, it's important to remember that inflation reached 5% at one point during 2008 and about just over 4.5% in underlying terms. That was much too high. But the earlier period of tight monetary policy and the weakening in demand in late 2008 associated with the intensification of the financial crisis has seen inflation come down. Over the past year, it was about 2% on a CPI basis and about 3.25%, we judge, in underlying terms. Over the past 6 months, underlying inflation ran at an annualised pace of under 3%, and we think it will be about 2.5% in 2010. It's normal, of course, given the lags in the inflation process, for inflation to keep coming down a little bit, even as the economy has begun to firm. With the economy having had only quite a mild downturn, however, we start the new upswing with less spare capacity than would typically be the case after a recession. One measure of that is that the rate of unemployment peaked at less than 6%, much lower than we or most others had forecast. Only a few years ago, unemployment rates like that would have been seen as a good outcome in strong times, let alone in times of economic weakness. The general flexibility in the labour market, including the ability of firms and employees to adjust hours of work, limited the rise in the numbers unemployed. But also the overall size of the downturn in economic activity proved to be considerably smaller than thought likely a year ago. This is, of course, a very good outcome. But it also means that there's less scope for robust demand growth without inflation starting to rise again down the track. Monetary policy must therefore be careful not to overstay a very expansionary setting. This situation is quite different from those faced by the major economies. Whereas many of them had their worst recession since World War II, we had probably our smallest. As such, it should not be surprising that Australia was among the first countries to begin raising interest rates once it was clear that the danger of a really serious contraction in economic activity had passed. And the board, as you said, Mr. Chairman, lifted the cash rate in October, November and December. Most lenders raised borrowing rates by a little more than the cash rate. Allowing for those margin changes, borrowing rates are still below average, but not by as much as the cash rate is. We've taken careful note also of non-price credit conditions. For large firms, access to capital market funding, both debt and equity, has been good. For some other business borrowers, access to credit has remained difficult, though we are seeing suggestions in our liaison now that this may be starting to ease. Furthermore, it appears that the rate at which lenders are having to make provisions for bad loans has slowed noticeably. That's not surprising, given that economic conditions have been improving. Given that, it's reasonable to expect that lenders will probably become more willing to lend over the coming year. That said, it seems unlikely that we will return to the easy credit conditions of 3 years ago. The world has changed, at least for a while. Moreover, the likely course of international standards for regulation over the next few years will probably, at the margin, act to raise the cost of intermediation by requiring banks to hold additional capital and liquidity. If economic conditions evolve roughly as we expect, further adjustments to monetary policy will probably be needed over time to ensure that inflation remains consistent with the target over the medium term. This is a normal experience in an economic expansion. As economic activity normalises, interest rates do the same. Though, of course, it's the interest rates borrowers actually pay and that savers receive that are important, not so much the cash rate per se. And the board sets the cash rate with that in mind. Mr. Chairman, I've said previously in these hearings that I thought Australia would come through the global crisis well placed to benefit from renewed expansion. For a time, the challenge was to sustain confidence, to support the economy and the financial system through some exceptionally demanding circumstances. By and large, I think those efforts were successful. Now, we must turn our attention to the challenges of managing an economic expansion. Issues of capacity, productivity, flexibility, adaptation to structural change and so on will all come back to the fore as they should. For our community to tackle those challenges successfully, one important condition is monetary and financial stability, and the Reserve Bank will do all it can to secure that. I'm looking forward to your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Governor. Governor, at past hearings you've spoken about the emergency levels that the cash rates have been to, and then at our last hearing there was discussion about a move back to normal rates. The Deputy Governor spoke about, on the 16th of December, about rates being in a normal range now, albeit in an expansionary segment of that range. Of course, the question that everyone out there in mortgage land wants to know is how close to your definition of normal are we now, and what sort of prospects are we seeing in terms of that return to normal, given that the Deputy Governor has said that we are in the normal range?
Well, I think what you said, Rick, was that when you allowed for the changes in margins, that the current setting was more equivalent to a cash rate that would in the past have been a higher figure than we actually see. Is that?
That's right, yes.
So I think the way I'd characterise it is I don't think we're in emergency anymore. I think we've done enough to lift off that. I would say that if you looked at the borrowing rates being actually paid on average by both business and housing borrowers, they're still below what I'd call an average for the past decade or so. They're probably between 50 and 100 points below that average,
yep,
something like that. So we're a fair bit closer to normal now than we were when we last met with you, given what we've done and what the banks added on top of that. When we eventually get to normal, there's a bit more work to do there, but that's the order of magnitude I think we're talking about.
So we're talking about still a move in terms of interest rates going up between 50 and 100
basis
points.
We're still below normal, I would say, which hitherto I think has been the appropriate place to be. But there's still a little distance to go yet before I think you could characterise the setting of interest rates as normal or average.
It was
just not as much as by doing a calculation off the cash rate, that's all.
Yes. It was somewhat a surprise for the market with after your last meeting that the cash rate didn't move.
Mm.
Are you able to give us a few more details as to your thoughts in keeping the cash rate where it was, given your last comments about still being some way away from the average or normal rate?
Well, I think it's true, as you say, that there was some expectation. There was near unanimity amongst economists, at least by the day of the meeting. There hadn't been up until a couple of weeks leading up to the meeting. The market pricing on the day was, I think, maybe 75% chance of move, so that wasn't unanimous. But I think, you know, if we went back to the bank's language at the December statement, the minutes of that meeting and Rick's speech, I don't think people would have taken, and they didn't, when those communications came, take it as a certainty that we were going to raise rates again in February. It was an open question. I think that was appropriate for us to leave it open. I think what happened was that during the holiday period, some people read some of the incoming data a little differently to the maybe the way we were going to read it, and so they were a bit surprised. These things happen from time to time. But our reasoning, and it's set out in the minutes of the February meeting, which minutes have we just released? We've released February, right?
Yeah.
I'm losing track of time. The reasoning is fairly clear, and it's that the board felt that having done three moves and seen the banks add to that, so we've really had three and a half move, or if you're a customer of Westpac, four, we're in front of the game enough that we have some scope to just have a little look at the initial effects of that on borrowing behaviour, the economy and so on. Now, the full effects take a long time to come through and you can't wait for all of that, but I felt, and I think the board agreed, that we had the scope to spend that month to have a look at how things were travelling. I think that was the right thing to do, and you know, the whole point of starting early and promptly is that you get that luxury of occasions where you can wait a little bit later down the line. If you just start late, you don't have that luxury. So that's why it's almost always better to be reasonably prompt, particularly if you're starting at fairly extreme levels, which we were. So that's the reasoning, and as I say, it's all in the minutes. And I still think it was the right call.
So in terms of that reasoning and the comments you made today about the distinction between the cash rate and borrowing rates that banks are out there doing, I think you've made it pretty clear that you take into account the actual rates that are being borrowed out there in terms of the movements of the cash rate.
Yes, indeed. You see, the cash market, it's a very important market, it's a very special market, and there's not that much borrowing actually goes on in that market. It's an interbank overnight professional market, but most of the borrowing by the end customers out in the country is not happening at the cash rate, it's happening at some sort of rate that banks set with reference to the bank bill rate or their funding costs and so on. So the effect that we're having on borrowers is actually through those borrowing rates. And the cash rate's a way of moving those, But when there's a bit of slippage between the cash rate and those other rates, well, we have to compensate for that to the extent we can. And we did that both the previous time we were tightening. We ended up doing less than we would have, I think, because those margins started to widen. When we came down, we went more than we might otherwise have done at the margin because the spreads were tending to widen. And we're still taking account of movements in those spreads, and that's appropriate because it's those rates that people actually pay, or that savers are actually getting on their savings, that are actually doing the work.
Your statement gives if I could describe it as a confident, but let's not be complacent, view of where we are in terms of leading into the recovery. The consideration of the problems in Europe, particularly Greece and sovereign debt, were they also considerations in pausing the...
At the margin, they are. Mm. There's a bit of uncertainty about how that's all going to be resolved. I don't think myself... at this point, that those issues will directly present a serious problem for Australia. After all, it's a sovereign debt issue for Europe, and the issue they've got to deal with is a credible way of sorting this out and preserving European unity and sound finances and so on. Our sovereign position is just so... it couldn't be more different, really. Maybe you could find one or two countries more removed from these sovereign risk issues than us. I can't think of who they are at the moment, though. We are in such a different position. So I don't think that's directly going to affect our kind of sovereign issues. If it all went pear-shaped and affected the global recovery, well, that's something to watch. But... at the moment, I think that was a reason at the margin to be prepared to wait if you had the luxury of waiting, which we did. There are other reasons to wait as well in February, more to do with wanting to just see a little bit more information on the local economy. I think they're more important to us than the Greece story, but at the margin, the potential for turmoil from Greece is obviously there. And
You've made the comparison in your answer just then between highlighting Australia's position in terms of sovereign debts and saying that we're as far removed from that as you can think of in terms of another country as an example. You'd agree with me then that the comments that Senator Joyce made were just simply wrong in relation to his commentary on Australia's position with sovereign debt.
Well, I take it you refer to comments about default.
Yes.
I think it is... well, there are a few things less likely than Australia defaulting on its sovereign debt. We've never had... there's never been a default by this country. I don't think there's ever been a default by any of the states. With one exception for one day, which the Commonwealth stepped in and fixed in 1931. But, there's never been... an event of sovereign default by Australia, as far as I know, and I very much doubt there ever will be.
So those comments from Senator Joyce weren't helpful, were they?
Well,
you're putting him in a very uncomfortable position here, Craig.
We'll move on. I think it was Senator Joyce who probably put the Governor in an uncomfortable position, to be fair. On page 35 of your paper, The 50 Years of Monetary Policy, What Have We Learned?, you stated that there may well be attractions for fiscal authorities in committing to a path of relatively rapid fiscal consolidation, thereby allowing monetary policy to be more accommodative than otherwise. Mm. How does this statement relate to Australian fiscal policy?
Well... as would be clear from the wording at the bottom of page 1 and on the top of page 2 in bold, the paper is not intended to provide any particular message about current issues for monetary policy in Australia. So I was not intending to make any points about fiscal matters here. This paper, you know, it's a 50-year perspective, it's international in its perspective, and the point it's making in this section is that globally, and Australia would be included in this bit, everywhere we've seen much more active use of fiscal policy recently than we have for a long time. Now, that is understandable and I think made sense in the circumstances of that we faced. It raises some issues as to how fiscal policy around the world will be conducted in the future. And one of those is the timing of the consolidation. And this is a very important question, less for us, really, than for Europe or the UK or the US, these kind of countries that have budget deficits of 10 and 12% of GDP, debt ratios of 80, 90, 100% or more, they're going to have to get on a track back to sustainability. But as I said at the beginning, they don't want to abort their recoveries in so doing, and so there's a fiscal monetary mix issue there. And this is really just making that point. No particular message was intended for Australia here, as I think was clear in the disclaimer at the front of the paper, which most people who've reported the paper have overlooked, I notice.
Yes, one person in particular. So Mr. Hockey's comments in relation to trying to characterise your statements as commentary on the Australian situation, clearly from your answer, is not the case.
Well, it was a paper presented to a 50th anniversary symposium. It's about 50 years of monetary policy and then casting our eyes a decade into the future. That's what it was about.
But the link is there. There is a link between fiscal policy and excessive fiscal policy or excessive government spending and interest rates. That is correct.
Well, in principle, that link is always there.
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you.
Can you make that point? Yeah.
Yeah.
The government is already undertaking what could be considered a relatively rapid fiscal consolidation. MyIFO reporting that we're tightening in the order of 1% of GDP per year. Is that consistent with the commentary you were making in relation
well,
to those issues?
I think that most of the improvement that's there is going to be parameter variation, isn't it? So the economy is improving, and that means that the automatic stabilisers that produce more revenue and less spending as growth picks up are working as they should, and the thing for governments to do is to let that happen as it wants to occur. So that's actually what's doing the relative improvement compared to the previous estimates, as far as I know, rather than new policies, although I might have missed something, but I think it's mainly that the economy is improving and helping the budget, which is a normal feature and something we ought to welcome. And I think I foreshadowed at an earlier meeting of this committee that I thought the likelihood was that we weren't going to reach the debt peak that had been projected because things would turn out better. And I think they are turning out better.
One final question from me. There's been some commentary about fiscal and monetary policy and how they've worked together or not worked together, depending on who's making the commentary. Do you care to make any comment in relation to the way in which they've operated since we've last met? And more generally?
Well, I think the general story when we met last time was that it was understood that once the job had been done, both arms of policy have to move in a direction of withdrawing stimulus. Now, we've begun our withdrawal. I think it's still our assessment, Phil, I think, that the peak effect of the budgetary measures on the growth rate of demand was in the middle of last year. Its peak effect on the level of demand's about now. And it should, if things run to time, it's important that they do, tail off over the year ahead. So I don't think I have anything new to say about that. For both arms of policy, I suppose, we have to keep re-evaluating the outlook for the economy and amending our trajectory. In our case anyway, it's easy to amend. It's not as easy to do with fiscal policy. But, you know, we can amend, if necessary, the pace at which we withdraw our stimulus as views about the outlook shift. Views about the outlook are somewhat more optimistic now than they were in August.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Briggs.
Thank you, Chair. Just a slightly different track, Governor. On the 2nd of November last year, there was an article in the Late Line Business Program about suggestions that the Reserve Bank selectively leaks, the executive selectively leaks the likely outcome of the board meeting prior to the board meeting. The presenter, as best summarised it, I guess, says, certainly there's disquiet among market economists that the Reserve Bank is selectively briefing certain journalists in the lead-up to rate decisions. Many argue this practice undermines the board process. I'm just interested, did you see the report? And do you
I did see the report. There weren't too many selective leaks, apparently, in February, because everybody was surprised. So.
Well, there was one of the journalists.
Sure, but I'm not sure what to make of all this.
So you...
No, people don't leak the outcome for a start. You know, the staff don't take calls from the media after the relevant internal meetings where we've come to the view what we're going to recommend, and that's usually on the Thursday morning. Papers go that day, that night. Secondly, you know, we can't be certain that the board will do what we recommend.
Mm.
It's a board of 9 people, and I can assure you they're all of independent mind. So people don't leak that information. The Reserve Bank never has leaked, in my experience, and if I can help it, never will.
So you looked internally after the article, I presume, to ensure yourself that that was, or assure yourself.
I'm quite confident that the processes we have are quite robust.
Mm. Okay, thank you. The paper on February 9 that we've discussed already, the synopsis, symposium I should say, you discussed the issue, as you did last time before this committee, about the so-called leaning against the wind or asset price targeting. How developed is your thinking on that issue and the bank's thinking on that issue?
There's a big difference between leaning into and targeting asset prices.
Mm.
I don't actually favour, at this point in time anyway, having an asset price. You'd have to, you know, which asset price would you be talking about for a start?
Mm.
There are many assets. But I don't favour having a target. But I think, you know, if we put this in historical perspective, which is what the paper tries to do, there have been two views for... ever since the Japan bubble period, really, this debate's been going. So that's not far short of 20 years. One view was that you should lean into these asset booms. And it's really, I might say, it's not the asset price per se so much as the leverage. If we have an asset price boom in old masters paintings and a few rich people speculate there and some of them lose money, but it's not borrowed money, well, you know, so be it. If it's houses and half the population is doing it and they're all geared up and a housing price collapse renders banks insolvent, well, that's a very different proposition, right? So it's the leverage that really matters. So the lean into the win view is that these dynamics are sufficiently dangerous that you ought to be prepared to lean on them a bit, even a bit, and use all the tools that you've got at your disposal, which would include interest rates but not be limited to that. There will be other tools. And the idea of that is that even if that slows growth for a little while, that's probably better than having a major crash in 3 or 4 or 5 years' time. That's one view. The other view was the clean-up after view. That view is that the dynamics of these things are so unstable, it's so hard to pick whether it's a bubble, etc. The best thing to do is to just not worry too much about them, respond to the normal things you respond to, and if there's a bust, then you ease aggressively to help the economy. Now, and that was the Greenspan Fed view. One difficulty that view's encountered, I think, is that the mess proved to be so big that conventional tools have found it pretty hard to clean up on this occasion. So I think the weight of opinion is tending to shift a bit. You know, if you think of there being a spectrum of ignore them, or every time you see an asset price move that might possibly perhaps be a bubble, run out and hit it with a hammer. You know, if there's a spectrum there, my guess is that opinion's shifting a bit in the direction of being more active without going all the way to total aggression. I personally think that that's the likely outcome as people evaluate this episode as they look back. Phil, you've worked on this a lot. Is there anything you want to add to
that? I think it's important that people don't think of this as the central bank targeting asset prices or pricking asset price bubbles, because I don't think anyone thinks that's sensible. The issue is really if you're seeing imbalances develop in the financial system, what should monetary policy and regulatory policy do? And as the Governor said, I think the weight of opinion is shifting towards the view that both regulatory and monetary policy needs to do something. So these financial imbalances arise, I think, if credit's growing very quickly, if asset prices are growing very quickly, and you've got a lot of innovation and competition and new things happening in the financial system. That particular cocktail leads to risk building up. And I think there is a strong case for the central banks and the regulators to take note of that and not just stand by and allow the balances to build up and then ultimately correct. Mm. But it's not about targeting asset prices. It's not about pricking bubbles. It's about responding to financial developments in a sensible way.
I might add that we've always felt that the inflation targeting system, some people are presenting this as a failure of inflation targeting. Mm. Targeting CPI inflation was all a big mistake because all these asset prices got out of whack and that's all brought us undone. Well, possibly in some countries that might be the story, but in our case, our inflation targeting system's always had sufficient flexibility to A, take account of the business cycle economic activity in a reasonable way, and B, at least make sure that we were not unduly, with a very easy monetary policy setting, fostering a rapid growth of credit and asset prices. And many people quote the episode in 2003 where the Reserve Bank tightened monetary policy, said a lot about housing prices, which were escalating quickly at that time, people were becoming very buoyant. And Ian Macfarlane had a lot of what we've called open mouth operations, saying you've got to calm down. And there were a couple of quick rate rises, which would have needed to be done anyway under the inflation target, but we possibly did them a little earlier than was absolutely necessary. But that episode, I think, successfully helped to just calm down, at least for a while, a housing market that was getting a bit overheated. So we've always felt there's an amount of flexibility we have to take account of these things in a sensible way without throwing away our main framework. And I think that's the thing to preserve. The framework we've got's good. We don't want to throw that out. We just don't want to let a very narrow-minded mechanical interpretation of it blind us to the potential for these other imbalances to develop, which will bring us undone later on. That would be our view.
So the statement, the 96 statement, which gives you your independence, and I noticed in Paul Kelly's book there was a reference on page 117 to in 1994 the then Prime Minister influencing a decision of the bank, which of course doesn't happen anymore post the 96 statement. Would you consider that that statement would need to be altered with the government if you wanted to change the way or increase the focus you put on these issues?
I'm not writing to the Treasurer saying, look, we've got to reword this thing. I don't really feel exercised about that. These things will be rethought next time there's a new government or a new governor, and it'll be for those people at the time to decide whether there's some words about this. But I don't feel myself that we need a wholesale rewrite of that at all. I think that system, the fact that it's been, we're on the third version of that statement now, last issued in 2007. It's in operation for the term of this government or my term, whichever ends first, and it's been going for more than a decade. The inflation targeting framework itself has been going for 16 years. I think this system is working pretty well. So we don't, in my view, need any kind of major surgery here. What we should always be doing is watching the evolution of knowledge and experience and, integrating that into the way we conduct ourselves within the framework. But I think the framework gives us adequate scope to do that.
Just finally, Chair.
Mr. Bilson's got to come back.
Yesterday, Dr. Lowe made some comments in relation to labour market flexibility, and we've discussed labour market flexibility at each of these hearings from memory, each time I've been part of it at least, and that. Noticeably, the Labour members don't discuss it. And I noticed today in your statement you identify again the importance of the flexibility in the labour market. There's a story in today's Daily Telegraph about Japanese business leaders warning that a fresh wave of union militancy threatens billions of dollars of investment in the country. Last time at this hearing we discussed the risks about the supply chain from Western Australia and so forth. Over the last 3 or 4 months there's been Workplace Express has reported at least 9 disputes. And Paddy Crumlin, the head of the MUA, one of Craig's friends, has commented that anyone who thinks the productivity increases need to be attached to wage increases is a dinosaur. Are you concerned about the direction of the labour market?
Well, I would have to observe, I guess, that in that sector, those who represent the workforce are operating in a pretty strong environment right now, and I guess they're seeking to use that, which is their job. I'm not sure what more to say about IR issues than I've said before. Flexibility is important. We've seen that in recent years, both in the boom, where I think we got through that much better than we would have in the bad old, incomparably better than we would have 30 years earlier or with 30-year earlier structures. And we've seen it in the downswing with the way the flexibility in the systems enabled employers to keep people on payrolls at reduced hours, all these sorts of things. It's very important. I guess the test is going to be how the new arrangements are basically administered and implemented by all the parties that are involved, which will be the employers, the unions, the Fair Work organisation, and so on. And it's important that all this be done sensibly. It's extremely important. And flexibility is as key now as ever. And for us to get the most value as a nation out of the opportunities that the growth of Asia into the future presents, we want to retain that flexibility. There's no question about that. It's hard for me to judge how serious the problems are because I'm not in those firms. I can only record that a lot of business people are expressing concern at the moment.
Yeah, but just finally, Chair, you have stressed before this committee before and elsewhere that wage increases need to be attached to productivity increases. If that becomes a problem, and it increasingly becomes a problem that there are wage increases outside of genuine productivity increases, that the system of bargaining that's operated for 15 years starts to fall down again, will that pose pressures, increased pressures for interest rates?
Well, a rise in unit labour costs is going to push up prices, all other things equal. We will respond to that.
Yeah, thank you.
If it's coming. But the long-run implication of excessive wage pressure is actually unemployment, because the central bank's job is to make inflation at the target. Industrial relations arrangements in the end will determine what rate of unemployment coexists with that.
Before we go to Ms. Jackson, just to follow up on that, you did, in making the point about unemployment in your opening statement, you made a statement about the existing flexibility in the labour market, including the ability of firms and employees to adjust hours as being a contributing factor to limiting the effect of the global financial crisis on unemployment.
It has been. Yeah. But, of course, the new arrangements are just coming in. So, the test is whether the flexibility is retained. I'm not saying it won't be. I can't judge. But the question that's being asked is whether that's a potential risk. And, you know, as I say, it's important to retain flexibility, and it will be up to... It's very important that all the parties involved do that.
You've also made comments in the past, I think on the first hearing of this government, about the need, in your view, of government to balance fairness as being a consideration in relation to industrial relations.
Well, in our community, people think fairness is important. And what I've said is that, you know, to the extent that there's a need to balance fairness and efficiency and other considerations, that's your job in the Parliament. It's your prerogative to do that.
Before I go to Ms. Jackson, just say that I think Paddy Crumlin is a very good union official, but we have very rarely held any economic views that are in common. Ms. Jackson.
I'd like to talk about bank funding for a little time. Mm-hmm. And I think you'd agree with me that there's been suggestions from the banks that one of the reasons why their own rates have moved in the way they have is because of the cost of bank funding. I note that there is some, updating of prudential standards that may have require banks to, you know, hold greater deposits or higher proportions of capital and other liquid assets. And we're also told that the Bank for International Settlements recently talked about requiring or issuing proposals to strengthen global capital. And I think it's fair to say that the Australian banks are concerned about the implications for this on the cost of bank funding. And I guess I'm curious about the RBA's view on the regulations, both the prudential standards as well as the possible global requirements for promoting, well, I think they're promoting or intended to promote a more resilient banking sector, and I say that in the context that I still understand the Australian banking sector can hold its head very high in terms of, you know, it's particularly through the global financial crisis. So,
Let me try to take that in two parts. I'll say a little bit about the regulatory issues, and I might get Rick to talk, if he can, about what is actually happening to funding costs and what our analysis is showing there, and we're going to publish something on this fairly soon. On the international regulatory side, well, there's a very big push emanating from the G20, among other places, for stronger standards to make banks safer. And the targeted banks, when they're thinking of this, is the 30 or 40 globally active, very big institutions which took more risk than they should have, given the capital they had, got into serious trouble, therefore placed immense strains on their home economies, on the global financial system, and in some cases required considerable amount of taxpayers' money in their own country to rectify the situation. So we're talking about big globally active banks in the US, Europe, UK, Switzerland, you know, a few countries like this. Now, the central, the engine room of banking supervision standards globally is the Basel Committee on Bank Supervision. It's not actually the BIS, it's just a committee that the BIS supports, but it meets in Basel. And the outcome of that is likely to be tougher capital requirements, particularly on trading book assets, securities that banks trade for their own purposes, tougher standards on liquidity. There is talk of maybe even tougher again for banks that are regarded as quite too big to fail, unquote. And then there are various regulatory initiatives at a national level, some out of the US, some out of the UK, about prohibitions on certain things banks can and can't do. What we've said, I've said publicly, is that we want to be sure that in addressing the egregious problems that these 30 or 40 large institutions created, we don't unnecessarily and inadvertently impair the thousands of other banks in the world who have been okay. Not that we shouldn't change standards and lift them at all. We will. It is inevitable after an episode like this that the standards are going to require, you know, tougher conditions on capital and so on. But this needs to be calibrated in a way that helps make the system more resilient to the next crisis, and there'll be one day, but doesn't impair our capacity to get out of this one. And we're, you know, the next crisis is not soon, I don't think. It's some time off, so we have time to get this right. So my point is to do this very carefully and not rush through a sort of half-thought set of proposals. The local banks here are quite exercised about the liquidity standards in particular. The reason for that, one reason for that, is that as initially drafted, these standards require much higher holdings of government securities because they're very safe. Now, on the standards literally interpreted, there are not enough government securities in this country for the banks to hold, which actually goes to the debt issue. You know, there isn't very much government debt here. So, you know, that standard obviously isn't feasible, literally, here. I think some reasonable arrangement can be made with sensibly drafted standards with a reasonable degree of national flexibility that will be able to have an arrangement for banks here that addresses the fundamental issue of needing to manage liquidity carefully but doesn't, you know, give us a silly rule that can't be met. This is really APRA's job, not ours. We're an interested party and we have discussions with them and with the banks about it, but in the end it's an APRA responsibility. But I'd be pretty confident that that'll work out okay. But the broader international thing, my point is that it's very important that all the proposals that are on the table can be very carefully analysed by the experts, with great respect to the political process, it has to allow time for that to happen and not press too hard for deliverables at meetings too quickly, because there's a work stream called a quantitative impact study that all the Basel Committee countries, from where one, go through, where you very carefully analyse what the quantitative impact of the proposals are and how they add up. It's very important that work be done carefully, systematically, and that the time be allowed for it to take place so that the new rules can be appropriately calibrated. We don't want to, in our efforts to ensure we never have this crisis again, actually give ourselves a different problem. So that's important. Now, I've said a lot there. Rick, would you be able to talk about the funding cost issue, what's happening here?
Sure. Well, the general point is that the more capital and the more liquidity you force banks to hold, the more it will push up the interest rates they have to charge borrowers, because they have to make up that extra cost somewhere else. As Glenn said, there's initiatives around the world at the moment to look at those issues, but they're still being calibrated, so we don't really know what the impact of that's going to be. The other thing that's going on at the moment is there's been a general tendency for supervisors and rating agencies to try and encourage banks to move more and more of their funding to deposits and long-term debt. And the banks have responded to that by bidding much more aggressively for those things. And so we've already seen the impact of that here, so and particularly for bidding for deposits. So over the long run of history, banks on average used to probably pay about 150 basis points less than the cash rate for deposits. Now, because they feel under pressure to increase the share of their funding that's coming from deposits, the interest rate they're paying there on average is equal to the cash rate. And as you know, for some special term deposits, you can get interest rates of over 6%, which is well above the cash rate. So this is adding to the cost of funds. So there's been a movement of competition from the banks. So through the period when credit was easy, banks were competing very aggressively on interest rates on loans. Now the competition has shifted very much to competition for deposits, because that's a binding constraint on banks' balance sheets. And so that's where the competition is at the moment. It's really pushing up the cost of funds to the banks. And as I say, once the Basel Committee and the Financial Stability Board determine these other rules on capital and liquidity, there could be further implications of that if they are very strict rules. So these are all things that are going to impact in the period ahead.
And these are things that you factored into, you know, your considerations. I mean, what you're saying is that potentially we're facing a substantially longer-term higher cost of bank funding for some time to come.
These are medium-term things, the Basel, because they won't come in for a couple of years. But we've certainly been factoring in the observed funding cost increases because of this deposit competition and so on. That's actually happening now as opposed to in the future. And, you know, I think we have been factoring that in, and we'll need to continue to do so, I suspect.
And in addition to the deposit competition, it's also about accessing funds from overseas and the cost they're paying for accessing those funds.
That's right, yes, because there's also been a premium on banks borrowing longer term, and for some of that longer term money they have to go to overseas markets where the cost is quite high.
So we're likely to see for some time some still pressures on credit availability.
Well, I think we're still seeing at the moment some, you know, elevated costs relative to the cash rate of some of the sources of banks' funding. It's a complicated story what's actually happened to date, and we're going to publish in our forthcoming bulletin, which is coming out in March, an update of a piece that we had a while back on what's actually happening to funding costs and margins. And you know, the story had been that initially net margins were squeezed in the first part of the crisis, then that was recovered as banks raised their loan rates relative to funding costs. And, you know, we're going to give the next instalment in that, which will bring us up to late last year, I think, in this forthcoming piece, which is an aim to actually give everybody, it aims to give everyone a framework, because in this whole debate about funding costs, everybody talks different languages, it gets very confusing. So we were trying to say, here's a framework with a common language, and you can all drop your own assumptions in and go from there, but at least we're in the same framework. The broader sweep of things that we're talking about with these possible regulatory changes, we went through many years where the cost of credit was cheap, where competition around the world, including here, was aggressive, where risk margins got bid down, where funding for banks to do all this was easy and inexpensive, and banks, not our banks, but some of the really big international banks actually didn't have enough capital for the risks they were really running. And in the future, for some time, that meant the cost of intermediation was cheap, and so a lot of it was used. I think we're going to be, for a while, in an era where that's not true anymore, where the cost of intermediation is going to be higher than it was, because regulators will insist that you have to have the amount of capital needed for the risk that you're taking, where capital market investors are more wary of extending cheap credit to entities and so on. That's a kind of, you know, shift of an era.
And not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, it's...
Well, it's a good thing for stability, because less risk ends up getting taken, at least for a while. Eventually, the clever people are going to find out ways to take it anyway. But that'll take a while. For some time, less risk generally is going to be taken. And those, for the community, for the global community who use the intermediation services of the financial system, the cost of that service, which is really measured by the spread between what they borrow at and what they lend at, is going to be a bit higher than it used to be. I can't see how that's really going to be avoided.
Just one final question on a slightly different tack is house prices. Mm. And you talk about how there's been growth, I think even in your statement, was it smartly, smart growth of 13%?
Yeah.
I wonder if you're not concerned that that this kind of rate of growth...
Well, I think... I think it would be concerning if it continues. It's quite strong. But in seeking to think about what it means, we've got to be, I think, conscious of a few things. Firstly, the rate of growth of housing credit behind that, it's about 8%, right? That's quite healthy. I wouldn't regard that as grossly excessive, though. I mean, it used to be 18. So one of the real worry points you're looking for is rapidly rising asset values, very strong growth in credit, declining lending standards. What we have is pretty strong growth in house prices over the past year. I'll come back to a nuance there in a moment. But credit growth is not too bad. You know, it's moderate. Lending standards for households actually are increasing, not falling. Banks are tending to reduce loan-to-value ratios. You've got to have a bigger deposit and so on. It's much, you can't get a no-deposit loan now, I don't think, etc. I welcome that. I think that's a very good thing. We might well see more of that if house prices continue to escalate, because the bank's own risk management themselves will be telling them, well, you know, be careful here and maybe be a bit tougher on the standards, and that's what they should do. So we don't see incredibly fast growth in credit, and we don't at the moment. We might, but at the present time we don't. We don't see lending standards falling. We see them rising. Possibly they need to rise more, I'm not sure, but at least they're moving in the right direction. The other thing to say is it's only tentative, but to my eye, the prices at the bottom end of the distribution, the cheaper end, have actually flattened off a bit over the past few months. Is that a fair call, Phil? And interest rates have risen. First home buyers, you know, the boost is now fading, and they are coming way back as a share of approvals. And so at that bottom end, at least at the moment, the prices may have stopped rising. That's tentative, and it mightn't persist, but, you know, it's not necessarily just, you know, pure blue sky right across the board. At the top end, it's very strong still. That end, I think, suffered a fair bit in the crisis. Bankers, corporate people who had a leveraged lifestyle all had to pull their horns in, and now they're feeling relieved that they lived and, you know, more confident. So that's a dynamic. And that is something to watch. But there's at least some perspectives on this issue.
Thank you.
Governor, we have a follow-up question from Mr. Turner, but we'll probably take that after the recess break. We'll go now instead to we have our school students who are here, and William Barker from Canberra Grammar has a question for you.
Mr. Stevens, what do you believe is the best policy in controlling asset price inflation and consequent over-leveraging, monetary policy or regulatory policy?
Both, I think. Probably we'll need to... It's a good question, William, very topical one. And I think the lessons that I would draw from what we've observed around the world is that regulatory policy needed to do more in containing risk-taking by intermediaries. And this is why we have a discussion now very actively internationally about so-called macroprudential tools, by which people mean tools which really bank supervisors have, like capital ratios, loan-to-value ratios and things like this, using those to kind of cap the upswing in credit and asset markets. But I, as we were discussing earlier, I think another lesson is that if you run along with very low interest rates, even if that might seem justified by inflation and so on, if you see a big rise in leverage and falling lending standards and rising asset values, you probably ought to be having interest rates a bit higher. And I don't myself feel much confidence that if interest rates were in the wrong place, that purely regulatory tools alone would be enough to contain it. I think we've got evidence in Australia's history that that doesn't work. So I think the simple answer to your question is, I suspect in a really big episode, you may have to contemplate both.
Thank you.
Governor, we've got Lillian Zagoski from East Hill Girls Technology High School.
Mr. Stevens, I learned that monetary policy is generally regarded as a blunt quantitative instrument, meaning implementations affect the entire economy. How can monetary policy target individual sectors to implement Reserve Bank objectives?
Well, it can't target in particular sectors very well at all. It is, as you say, Lillian, a policy which affects the overall economy. But our objective is an overall economy objective. Our objective is to keep inflation steady and to keep, subject to that being achieved, to try to keep the aggregate economy close to its potential path. So we're not trying to tweak specific sectors. The difficulties arise when one particular sector is doing much of the driving and pushing the overall economy off course, and of course when we respond to that, that sector will probably still be too strong and the other sectors will be a bit weaker than otherwise, but all we can do is make policy for the average, and that's all we've ever claimed we can. And so in that sense, it is a very general instrument. Calling it a blunt instrument, well, in a sense it is. Most economic policy instruments are actually fairly blunt, I think, when you come down to it. I'm not sure there are all that many sharp ones.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, Governor, I just wanted to specifically ask, there's a lot of discussion around increased funding costs and the impacts of the global financial crisis. Can you just quickly, because I think this is the issue that mortgage holders will want to know out there in the community, is that prior to the global financial crisis, what was the spread in terms of bank interest rates and the RBA's cash rate, and what is it now, and what proportion is the increase above the cash rate that we've been seeing related to increase in funding costs, and what proportion is related to the fact that there's less competition in the banking sector, and are there real risks at the moment that we're seeing banks being able to extract larger profits than they should because of a lack of competition as a result of the second-tier lenders disappearing through the global financial crisis?
But the pressures on funding costs and the disappearance of the second-tier lenders, that's the same thing. You know, you can't take those apart because those sorts of lenders relied more on wholesale funding and securitisation than the major banks do or did. And that business model is fundamentally, you know, just much less profitable, if profitable at all, in the environment that we now see. So I don't know that you can, you know, apportion these things. Rick, can you say what the spreads were pre and post? Do we have that?
Sure. Well, in terms of funding costs, and they've probably risen by a bit over 100 basis points relative to the cash rate since the pre-crisis period. Now, on top of that, bank margins. So just to give a history here, so if you go back about 10 years, the margins the banks charge is the difference between what their funding cost was and what their average interest rate was on loans. It used to be about 3.25% percent. And then over a decade or so of competition, so just before the crisis, that had come down to about 2.25%. So there'd been a 100 basis point squeeze in banks' margins over about a decade. Through the crisis period, that margin has since widened out to a little bit under 2.5%. So there's been about a 20 or 30 point widening in banks' margins, which is the difference between the average rate they pay on loans and the average rate, the average rate they receive on loans and the rate they pay on funding. In recent times, I think we're starting to see that margin contract again a little bit now at the margin. So I think as we go forward, we might well see that interest margin level out and even come down a little bit. I think we've seen some early signs of that. So the big story is the difference between the cash rate and the funding costs. That's where the big movements have been. And there's also been a marginal movement of about 20 or 30 points in the difference between what the banks are paying on deposits and what they're paying on receiving on loans.
Mr. Bilson, and I'd like to formally welcome you to your first...
Thank you. Feeling the love. Governor, I'd like to talk about inflationary pressures. We touched briefly on the concern in the business community about wage pressures without commensurate productivity gains. We've seen some very prominent examples of that. The bank itself, that 2 to 3% band, we've been outside that core inflation band for 2.5 years. We're now seeing the IMF saying, well, maybe 4% is the mark, and I wonder whether that's that definition of an economist that sees something in practice and wonders if it works in theory, that practice has been higher than that core rate, so why not adjust the targets? And also a lot of pressure on household budgets with cost of living increases. That paints an inflationary expectation fear in my mind. I'm wondering what you're observing and what you see into the future.
Well, it's true, as I said in my opening remarks, that inflation rose to be clearly excessive in 2007, which is why we were lifting rates. And it peaked in around about June or September quarter of 08, if I remember rightly. The latest figures for the CPI have actually been below the target until recently. That's, I think, the latest number is 2.1 over the year, so it's at the bottom of the target zone. That's being held down by some things that happened a year earlier. Petrol prices fell and so on. And so it's probably not a good gauge of the ongoing inflation rate. We would look at the various core measures that we compute a whole lot of, and they are coming down. In the last year, the answer is 3.25 on underlying measures is our take. The last 6 months, it's a bit under 3. The last 3 months, if you annualise that, it's about 2.5, which is right where we want to be. That's what we expected would occur, given that the economy slowed, we built up a bit of spare capacity, wage growth fell quite sharply last year, exchange rate went up.
There's that catch-up footy mood around in late market claims.
I think there probably is going to be some intention to catch up, and we're factoring some of that into our forward-looking assessment. That's why we think inflation is not going to keep falling. 9 months ago, we would have said inflation was going to keep falling down to maybe 1.5. Now the low point's 2.5, and we think probably if the economy works out how we expect, it would start to drift higher from there, which is why we're talking about, you know, we will need probably, if things work out as we expect, to tighten further. Expectations of inflation, I think, are okay at the moment. The various measures we take from bond yields or from the consumer survey that's done, they're kind of where they've been, I think, over the 15 or 20 years we've had low inflation. So I think they're reasonably well anchored at this time. That is, though, something that, of course, we watch very carefully. The high currency is helping us, and that will continue to flow through over the coming year, because that mechanism takes quite a while to fully work its way through. But the thing for us to be watching is how quick the pickup in demand is relative to available capacity. As I said at the beginning, we have some spare capacity generally in the economy, but a fair bit less than you would normally get if you had a serious recession. It's good that we don't have a lot of spare capacity. You don't want to have a lot, but equally, you want to be watching the pace of demand growth when you don't have much, because you're wary of the potential for inflation. So that's why we're, you know, in this period of moving off the emergency rates, and in, you know, over the period ahead, we're likely to be, if things pan out as we expect, continuing our way back to more normal settings.
You touched on your remarks and in the February Governor's statement about things improving for big business. I'm particularly concerned about the difficult financing environment for small businesses. The reduction in competition from the government's bank guarantee doing over an important source of competition for small business financing, the margins that are being asked of them, the restrictive terms and conditions, and 4 out of 5 in that PricewaterhouseCoopers survey saying a lack of access to funding's going to impede their achievement of targets this year. What's your take on that? And also the NAB just last week said that some of our domestic rules about capital charges
actually skew lending very much towards mortgage lending. And I think the quote was you can do up to five times more mortgage lending relative to business lending in terms of capital management, even if that same home's the security.
Well, it's an economic fact that lending for mortgages has historically been far safer than for other things. That's why the Basel process downweights the weighting on mortgages when you are calculating the capital charges. Certain mortgages in America, of course, proved to be much more risky than had been assumed. But leaving that aside, in this country, certainly, it has been and remains a very safe form of lending. But I think it's true that, you know, for a dollar of capital, if you were just earning the same returns, you can do more on housing. But this is why you charge more for business loans. That's why a business loan has a risk margin built in, which is considerably higher than a risk margin on a housing loan. So the banks compensate for that in the pricing. I think in terms of competition, there is a lot of focus, as we've heard in some of the earlier questions, on competition in the mortgage market. I don't actually think that's Australia's problem. I think we're going to have plenty of finance for housing because it's relatively safe and it's pretty easy to do. There's probably not quite as much competition at the margin as there was in that space. But some of the competition that was there was actually doing lending that really shouldn't have been done, so I don't think we're going to have a big problem there. The problem is more likely to be, as you say, for small business. I'm often asked what can be done about that, and I always have to say I don't have a policy silver bullet that would fix that. What I would say, though, is that in our liaison, which admittedly is sort of for medium and larger firms more than lots and lots of really small firms, well, we do have some engagement with small firms, but not as often. What we're hearing is that the proportion of respondents that are saying credit's getting tougher to get has gone down. Some of them are saying, actually, things are getting a little bit easier. We are hearing some reports now of some risk margins on larger firms starting to come down. I think that will follow to the medium and smaller ones over time. And the reason I think it will is that I think banks were being cautious, understandably, but probably a little more cautious than they might have needed to be, given the fears about how the economy would be very weak. They, like everyone else, have been pleasantly surprised that the provisions they're having to make for bad loans are not as high as they felt. Their balance sheets aren't growing because a lot of businesses are seeking not to have debt to economise, raise other funds or get their leverage down in some way. I think the banks are finding that the balance sheet won't grow. And, you know, they're not going to be as profitable as they want to be in that world. And so I think over the next year we will likely find that conditions for a range of businesses will get a little bit easier. They won't go back, though, to, if you think back several years where you had, you know, pretty easy credit conditions everywhere in the world, we had foreign banks in here aggressively competing and so on, that is not going to return in the near term. So I don't think we'll go back to that world, but I think we probably we'll see credit conditions not quite as hard as they are now in a year's time. But that's the best I can offer you, which maybe is...
Oh, there's still a spread of 2.5%, 3% for a borrower. It might be the same person with the same bank for the same sum of money with the same security of their home and their firstborn, which is increasingly being asked in small businesses. And there's still a big spread, and this is causing great grief. And so putting that to one side...
But the thing, it's a spread too, of course, is lower than it used to be.
The housing price bubble in Melbourne and parts of Sydney and in Brisbane, according to national valuation firms, is being exacerbated by the relaxation of foreign investment requirements. Seeing a lot of foreign money coming in buying selective properties that's having a vacuum effect to suck up the prices right across the market. If you are inclined to lean against the wind, and it may be an offshore breeze, sir, have you picked up that concern that that's starting to really be an influence on house pricing and house price inflation in some of our capital cities, and is there a need for policy action on that front?
Well, one certainly hears reports of considerable sums of foreign money around. Is that able to go into the established market, though?
Yes, it is now.
It is?
Yeah.
Well,
so government policy change.
I think that dimension of housing prices, there, you know, is kind of a global phenomenon too, which would have meant, of course, that when we think about what we do about it here, we would have to keep in mind that if it's global, we probably can't stop it that easily, at least not without more insulation between ourselves and the global system. But everywhere in the world, desirable property locations are seeing prices pretty high. I mean, in fact, it's a feature that while property prices have fallen in the countries that have had the worst crisis, even in the UK, they're starting to rise again now. And in a range of other countries that cut their monetary policy aggressively to counter the downturn, if their banking system wasn't impaired, a lot of them have seen house prices rise as a result. We're one of those, but there's a whole bunch of them in Asia. So it's an issue not just for us. I think, and of course, that money, if it's foreign money, isn't borrowed here, so even so-called macroprudential tools that we might use or APRA might deploy wouldn't make any difference either. So it's important to keep that in mind. I don't have a sense of, you know, how quantitatively prevalent that is relative to the local buyers. But I suppose it's one potential part of the explanation of how you've got quite high price rises in some top-end areas, but overall domestic housing credit growth is reasonably steady. Part of the picture.
I'll come back. Gee, this is an unusual invitation to keep going. Some of the Basel discussion around capital adequacy and the like, and we've heard that domestic banks are quite exercised by that, given that a lot of liquidity is held as other bank paper, and that there's a push against that to hold bonds, as you've discussed. That sounds like a very North Atlantic solution to a problem that doesn't exist here.
Mm.
How vigorous are you, sir, and your colleagues in those international fora, and how vigorous does the government need to be to make sure we don't get fitted up to a solution to a problem that's very North Atlantic and could gum up finance in Australia for quite a long period of time?
Well, we've made our points known, and APRA puts these points about the liquidity rules in particular through their membership of the Basel Committee, as do we. And I think what we need here is to just make sure that there's a certain amount of national discretion, which there always is in these capital rules. That's why Basel II took 20 years to negotiate, right? So we need to do that, which is why I say that it's imperative that these proposed standards be very carefully quantitatively assessed, thoroughly done, and with time to negotiate sensible flexibility for countries like ourselves. You're quite right to say it's a North Atlantic, that's a very good phrase. The whole crisis, actually, was very much a North Atlantic crisis. It was really only a global crisis for 6 or 8 weeks, I think. The rest of it's mainly a North Atlantic story. And the proposals to insist on... there is a problem with liquidity. And the problem was that institutions which relied on the assumption that wholesale markets would always be open at a reasonable price, and they just weren't open. You know, those people came into serious problems. And so there does need to be, I think, a genuine effort on the part of financial institutions to think more about liquidity, risk. One criticism of the Basel process, perhaps, is that for 20 years it was fixated on capital. Capital's important, but it didn't maybe spend enough time thinking about liquidity, risk, and that's now to be rectified. So that does have to be done. But it needs to be done in a way that is sensible. And, you know, we could go on, but the main point is that we do need to make sure that there's, as far as we can, that there's adequate national flexibility. We are saying that. And the work at the technical level needs to be done, needs to be allowed time so that this is all done sensibly.
One last question, if I may. The concentration of market power in the big banks, the demise or, let's say, suboptimal time the smaller banks and non-bank lenders have had of late, the impact of the government's bank guarantee, what do you see as the state of competition in Australia? Are you satisfied with the robustness of it, or and are there actions we could take to improve competition in banking?
I'm not sure I accept, to begin with, the guarantee per se did all that much to change competition. I think the environment changed the competitive position of those institutions. It's true that they didn't like the fact that the pricing had a risk tiering in it, and you know, I'm the one who wrote down the prices, so they can blame me for that. Not to my face, I know. I think it was appropriate to have risk-based pricing, incidentally. Whether we got the numbers exactly right, you know, obviously opinions can differ, but it is appropriate to have risk-based pricing. But the guarantee is phasing out now, so that's not going to be an issue. But I think in an environment where suddenly everywhere in the world there is a flight to safety, you're bound to see, as human nature, that bigger institutions are going to look safer to people. Whether they actually are safer or not, they're going to look that way. And we did see some of that. I actually think the system coped with that fairly well, by the way. I think the through sensible behaviour on everybody's part, we got through that flight to safety and came through pretty well. Competition is reduced in certain segments. As Rick said, it hasn't disappeared, it's been relocated. There's now intense competition on the liabilities side of a bank's balance sheet because of the environment that we're in. And a new sort of person is benefiting from that competition, people who haven't benefited from all that much over the years, namely savers. When we think about competition, we often worry about housing borrowers, that's fair enough, or business borrowers, fair enough, but what about the savers? We shouldn't forget them, and they're actually benefiting from the competition that's in place on the other side of the balance sheet at the moment. In the future, I think we could expect that securitisation, it is gradually improving. It will return as a funding source, but not in the same size. A lot of the buyers of the securitised mortgages, I think, Rick, were offshore. You know, the sieves and conduits and so on, well, they're not going to come back. So the size of those flows won't be what it was, but it will recover some way, and it will be, I think, again, a viable and useful form of funding, and at the margin a form of competition keeping the lid on mortgage costs. So for small business it's much harder because you can't securitise it. They're more idiosyncratic products, they're not homogeneous. So the bankers have to know the customer. And more resources are involved in doing that, and so it's harder to just generate competition through these market mechanisms. The best I can do, as I said before, is I think I think things are likely to get better as the year progresses because the banks will be keener to do it.
Mr. Fitzgibbon.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. Governor, I had two quick questions to ensure that everyone is provided with an opportunity, and thankfully Mr. Bilson beat me to the punch on the first one about Basel. But I just want to just add to that. I'm also concerned that, you know, we might be forced inevitably to take medicine we don't need here in Australia. And you've answered the question very effectively, but can I just ask whether anything Oliver Blanchard had to say in his paper gives you additional concern, given he's already being accused of laying the path, if you like, for the Americans to run a higher inflation rate. So, I mean, he... it could be argued that he's...
You mean his comments about inflation targets?
Inflation targets, and in particular the shift to a heavier regulatory environment, which arguably has the potential to be overdone with respect to our own situation here in Australia.
Well, I mean, there is a very strong line of thought in the major countries that we've just got to have stronger regulation, and I think that's understandable because to be perfectly frank, there were regulatory failures in these cases. But this is where perspective is needed, of course. You know, we were operating under Basel along with everybody else, but we didn't have a problem. Some of that is luck, but some of it is that we actually had an effective supervisor who did their job. I think even the supervisory community in the US and the UK and some other places would concede that there were supervisory practice failures there. And it's not a matter of just having the rules. You've got to enforce them properly. On inflation targets, I don't agree at all with what the IMF paper said there. The basis for the argument that maybe you need a higher average inflation rate is so you can then have higher average interest rates. And that means you could cut them more in an emergency. Yeah. And the reason they think that's a good idea is that these countries hit the lower bound of zero. Well, we have an inflation target centred on 2.5. We had 300 points left when we got to the bottom that we could have used but didn't need to. So it seems to me that this problem, in our case, has not arisen, hasn't anything like arisen. I think it might well be argued that some of these countries should have had higher average interest rates than they did, but they didn't actually need a higher inflation target to do that, I don't think. That is a line of argument that many people ran, that rates were just too low. But the other thing to say is that if you look at the countries that have had, let's take Japan, well, they never had an inflation target anyway, neither did the US. The UK did, but as many countries did not have them as had them that got into trouble, so I don't think where the inflation target was set was actually all that germane. And in the American case, the real problem was that they couldn't get the 30-year mortgage rate down. The Fed funds rate went to zero, but it didn't do much to bring the rate that the borrowers actually, this is the point we're making earlier, the rate the borrowers pay matters, not the central bank rate, because not many people borrow at that rate. The central bank rate's just a tool to move that other rate. And in their case, the tool... it didn't bring down the 30-year rate. In fact, that rate, I think, only started falling when the Fed started buying the Fannie and Freddie paper. So I think the fact they hit the zero bound and it was ineffective, something else was at work there, not what the right inflation rate. And after all, most of these countries operated perfectly well for 40 or 50 years before the high inflation of the 70s with very low nominal interest rates and low inflation rates, and they never got into a liquidity trap in those days. So I would not agree at all with the sentiments in that paper on inflation targets.
On economic capacity, you've been making the point since, I think, November last year that we go into this upswing with less capacity than was the case coming off the last two much more mild downswings.
You mentioned it again today. It's been reinforced by others. On each occasion, you've talked about employment and underemployment in particular. You haven't said much about capacity utilisation on the part of firms. I know it's not an exact science, but when I have a look at your chart, you see manufacturing well down, much more capacity there, and you give an explanation for that, world demand. But in the other sectors, construction and services, pretty much where they are back in 01, 02. So can we assume from that, and this is a very genuine question, can we assume from that that your absolute focus is on employment? And in addition to that, on that page you say that we consider really less spare capacity than earlier thought likely. Is that earlier than November 09 or earlier than today's hearing?
The point is that I could maybe tell this in terms of how the growth forecasts have evolved. That's a simple metric. At one point, I think we were forecasting GDP would fall 1% through 2009, December to December. And now the forecast is plus 2. So there's 3% more GDP, if our estimates are correct, than we thought. That pessimistic forecast, the people were most pessimistic about April last year, I would say. So if you think of where potential GDP is, we don't know, we can't observe it. But wherever it is, we're about 3% closer to it now than we thought we were going to be only 9 months ago. The capacity utilisation measures are from surveys, and what they show is they're clearly well down from the highs of 2007, but that was very high. You know, this economy was operating fully stretched, and we were seeing inflation pick up, as it turned out, even a bit more than we feared at the time. So that's clearly, you know, I think a point of overcapacity. We've got some spare capacity now, but compared with what you typically get if you have a real big downturn, with a lot less. Now, as I said earlier, that's good, but we just have to keep in mind that's our starting point as we head off into the future. On the labour market, well, there are, of course, as you refer to, many measures of underutilisation and so on, but as one broad summary metric, I think it's a pretty fair characterisation. If your peak unemployment rate's under 6 and then you're going down, which that's what it looks like, just eyeballing the numbers, you've started with a labour market that is going to get tight quicker than it has in other episodes, even the 2001 episode, where I think the unemployment rate is about 7.
Thanks. Just as a follow-up, though, on that, I suppose one of the differences in the unemployment figures in the downturn this time compared to some previous times is not only that unemployment didn't rise as much, but you've made the comment about the reduction in hours and part-time, and that's perhaps a unique feature for this occurrence.
It it happened in 2001 as well, but it's happened more this time, and of course the hours are now picking up. So we'll see. We should see, I think, Phil, we're going to see, we think, some of the take-up of labour demand is going to be more hours rather than more...
Yeah, I think going forward, in our forecast, we don't have the unemployment rate coming down that quickly because as the economy strengthens, we'll see average hours lengthen out and reverse that earlier decline. And so I think that's going to be the first thing we'll see, and then once that process plays its way through, then the unemployment rate would be, we'd expect that to come down more. But there is a reasonable amount of spare capacity there because people are working fewer hours.
You got a follow-up on this one?
How long do you see that stickiness in jobs growth as the extra capacity is absorbed in extra working hours? Do you have a sense for how long that stickiness might be?
I think it's hard to tell, but over the next 6 months to a year, one imagines that reduction in hours worked, in average hours worked, reverses itself. And so I think that it's hard to know exactly how long it would take, but I think that's the general...
The slight irony, of course, the number of jobs has been rising quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Apparently in the past 3 or 4 months, which makes it even harder to tell.
Yeah, Governor, good to be here again. I think you've already said this morning, described former Governor McFarlane's comments of being open-mouth surgery, and I think previously you've mentioned that Mr. Governor Bernanke in the United States has used jawboning in the past. Describing rates at emergency lows and more like to have a 5 in front of them than a 3, I think it was last time, would that be described as one of those, or do you have a particular name for it when yourself make comments like that?
Well, I was just responding to your questions, I'm sure. there's a lot of open mouth here this morning, which very dangerous thing for central bankers. But anyway,
what was that, sorry, Kavanagh?
There's a lot of my mouth open here this morning, and frequently that's a dangerous activity.
Maybe it's more appropriate for Mr. Battalino or Mr. Lowe. Is there a name that they give it at the bank and not if we call it open-mouth
service? Just say the governor's talking out of school again.
Phil just nods when he's asked. Is that right?
The point is, I suppose, is that is it picked up in terms of, and they were quite significant statements that you made last time, and they sent clear messages to the community and ran on the front page of the local papers and in all the news headline. Do you pick up that in your quantitative or qualitative data? Comments that you may make or that may be made around the world?
I think yes, it makes the front page of the papers, but I've noticed that anything said by the Reserve Bank that might possibly remotely be about interest rates makes the papers, whether it should or not. But commentary, most things that are said and make the front page of the papers pass within a few days.
They were significant statements, though, and obviously...
I think they were probably confirming what most people would kind of know, wouldn't they? If interest rates are at a 50-year low, you must have some emergency for that to be so. And most people would know that once the emergency passes, you probably shouldn't stay there. And I think, you know, it's important for us to articulate that, but I don't think too many people would have been surprised to hear that, mainly only at the timing, possibly. But
you made the comment, though, specifically today about Ian McFarlane, the former Governor McFarlane, in relation to that. I mean, have you picked up, or has there been work done that picks up that, particularly in qualitative or quantitative data, that that specifically goes to that issue about statements, particularly from people of influence like yourself in terms of confidence or perceptions in the work that you do in terms of the survey work?
I'm not aware of serious research on the effects of central bank comments on the real economy. There is a literature on things that move markets on particular days, of which central bank remarks are one thing, data is another thing. There is a literature on that, but I'm not sure that any of that's up to date enough to have measured any potential impacts of something I said at the last hearing, I'm afraid.
The point is, though, that things that you do say and things that significant people in the economic sphere say does have an influence on markets and potentially on interest rates.
Of course. That's why we always try very carefully to speak precisely, sometimes to be a little bit less clear than you might like.
Do you ask him to be less animated?
Alan Greenspan once said, one of my favourite quotes is that since he had become a central banker, he had learned to mumble with great incoherence.
But it would be fair to also make the point that if the Secretary of the Treasury were to speak in a way that could influence the market, and similarly the Treasurer or the Finance Minister of the country could similarly make statements that potentially impact and influence markets and the broader confidence in the economy, isn't it?
Well, people in positions of authority and responsibility certainly must be wary of the way they speak. I agree with that. I think there are some times when you've got to just say things like they are and the markets will move, but they have to move. But I think one has to be careful of inadvertently giving false impressions, to be sure.
So, and bringing this as a very serious point, is that we're coming to the point where we have a finance minister, Lindsay Tanner, and the opposition has a finance spokesman, Senator Joyce, and comments that they made would be, if they were the finance minister, could have impacts on markets and the interest rates and a range of different confidence levels in the community.
I'm not going to get into any further discussion, I don't think, about what the shadow finance minister said. I think there's been a fair bit of that already, hasn't there?
The point I was making, though, and you've outlined that anyhow, if they were the finance minister of this country, what they say would influence or could have influence in the markets.
Yes. I have yet to meet a finance minister who has ever mused any possibility about debt default, though, of his own country.
Just moving along from that, in terms of the... And I know in your statement earlier, and you were saying we're moving into a more expansionary and things are looking more positive going forward, and that we're sort of moving beyond the sort of focus on the downturn, particularly in Australia. What are some of the... You've obviously been working in the bank through a number of recessions and or downturns, and you said, I think, in some comments today that this has probably been the most... smallest one since the war, even though it's been some of the largest. Can you give us an idea about what your thoughts are, reflections? Because one time you keep in this game, moving on and focusing on the future. Yeah. What can we have learnt from our response to this global recession, from the way that the government and the RBA has responded?
Well, I think that's a very important question. There's still some debate over should it be called a recession or not. Let's leave that aside. If it was... it was probably the smallest one we've had probably since the war, I would say. It's a bit deeper than the mid-cycle slowdown we had in 2001, but not all that much. What should we learn? Well, I think the lesson we should not take is that Australia doesn't have recessions and that we won't have them in future and everything's rosy. The lesson we should take, because we will have them, I don't know when, but we will. I think it's virtually, that's just the nature of capitalist economies. The lesson we ought to take is that when they come, you maybe have some scope to influence, is it a big one or a little one? And you're right, I have lived through a few recessions in the 30 years I've been in the Reserve Bank, two bad ones, and then a whole bunch of mid-cycle slowdowns that were fine. So, and they're very different experiences. So the lesson we ought to be taking is, well, we had a small episode here. How was that? What did we do to make that happen? Now, you will point to, I'm sure, the fiscal measures and the very dramatic easing of monetary policy we had, and those things certainly helped to support the economy. But why could we do that? How were we able to do that? You can't just do that out of thin air. You have to build up, in the preceding years, years and years and years, the budget surplus, the reputation for a credible monetary policy, a level of interest rates that's appropriate for the economy through time, so that you can credibly do these things when an emergency comes and it works. There are some countries who can't do a fiscal easing today, even though they're in a deep recession. Greece is going to have to tighten fiscal policy in the middle of a bad situation because over a long run of time, there's not sufficient fiscal credibility being built up. We built it up through the previous government and, I have to say, the one before that as well, over many years. We built up monetary policy credibility through 20 years of hard work containing inflation. And we built up supply-side flexibility of the economy through many, many, many years of arduous grinding work on breaking down all the stuff that was wrong there. So the lesson we should take is all that was worth it because it's helped us here, as well as raising our living standards over time anyway. but that we have to reinvest in all that in the years ahead. So the lesson we should take isn't that we don't have recessions, that we get away with it. The lesson is that we have small ones if we've got the firepower and the credibility and the kind of presence of mind to act. But you can't act unless you've got the scope. And we had the scope because we built it. We've got to rebuild it.
So recognising the work of the Hawke-Keating government, the Howard government,
yeah,
was important.
Absolutely.
The cash payments, though, and the economic stimulus plan were also important in terms of preventing us going into a technical
recession. Well, as my colleague here said yesterday, I don't think there's any doubt that those measures supported demand. There was a long debate about whether they'd work. I think they worked. No doubt about that. The debate now really is, in fiscal, is going to turn to, as it should, efficiency and timeliness of withdrawal and all that. That's where the debate should be because we're in that phase now. It's good to be in that phase, actually. It's good to be in the phase where the policy measures taken to avert a serious downturn worked, and we're talking about what's the right path for exiting those and how do we manage an expansion. What a great problem to have. I can name a lot of other countries like to have it.
Yeah, taking that on board and going back to the point I was making before, having the shadow finance spokesman in my electorate yesterday saying that we're basically stimulating South Korea, China and Japan because people spent one-off $900 payments on rubbish in their homes doesn't go to the point that would be a responsible statement for a finance spokesman.
Well, I think in saying things like that, his job is to criticise, isn't it?
Plenty of material to work with.
Well, I thought his job was to be the finance spokesman and the alternative. Well,
Mr Chairman, I'm not going to get into more on what Senator Joyce said.
I think we'll move on. Ms Lay, welcome to the hearing as well.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chair. Mr Stevens, recognising, of course, that the Reserve Bank concerns itself with monetary policy, but also noting your comments on Australia's strong fiscal sustainability, can I ask you broadly how important you see the Henry Tax Review as far as setting a framework that will make it easier for Australia to sustain adequate growth into the future?
Tax is a very complex matter, and I don't know what's in the Henry Tax Review other than, we read the paper. I really can't give you many informed comments about tax matters because it's not my field. I can certainly agree that the structure of taxation and its level is a very important factor for efficiency in the economy. And that, I assume, is a large part of why the government called for the review. But what it will show recommend, I don't know. So I can't really offer a great deal of comment about that.
Well, if we leave aside the issue of the Henry Tax Review, are there changes to the tax system that you believe could help Australia on its path to sustainable economic growth? I mean, are there things that you hope may emerge that would make it easier for Australia to manage its growth into the future, given that you have identified that as a significant challenge, particularly in terms of the intergenerational report?
I don't have personally, and the bank doesn't have a position on what tax matters should be changed. One issue that my predecessor identified as important at one point was the whole treatment of capital gains on negative gearing and so on. But I don't want to put a position on that. I think we don't have the expertise tax, to me, I'm a simple central bank monetary economist type. So to my mind, tax is about supply-side efficiency. It's got to raise the revenue. We want to balance the budget. That's a fiscal policy question. The tax system has to do that, raise the necessary revenue, and do it in a non-distortionary way. And but those matters are really, how you do that exactly is in the province of people who are experts in tax, and there's really nobody better placed than Ken to head that review in that sense. But we don't have a set of things that we're looking to see emerge out of the review. We're spectators in this particular issue.
Chair, that's two questions. Can I have your indulgence for a third one quickly? As a rural member of this committee, can I just ask your impressions on what I think most rural members of Parliament would agree is an extreme tightening in the rural lending sector? Are we in fact seeing two speeds or two types of lending from banks where there's a greater preference for mortgages than there are for rural and agribusiness type loans?
I wasn't aware that there was major evidence of lending conditions in the rural sector tightening more than for other businesses. I'm not sure whether that's what you're suggesting, but I haven't heard that. And in fact, I would have thought there are one or two institutions in that sector who are looking to grow and who are in good shape. So the general issue of business versus housing, well, that goes back to the question that was asked by one of the colleagues over here earlier on. And it's true that the capital charge system does discriminate, but that's what it's supposed to do, because mortgage lending is less risky. And that's why business lending costs more to a business loan costs more to get. But there's no reason that should lead to an undue shortage of business loans over time if the risk is appropriately priced and the banks have adequate access to funding and capital, which I think they do. I don't know, Phil,
In our liaison, we've picked up that it has been very tight for firms in the rural sector, but I don't think it's been any tighter than for firms elsewhere in the economy. And as the Governor was saying before, at the margin, we're detecting things are easing a little, both in the farm sector and for the general community. So it has been tight, but I think the worst is probably over there.
Thanks, Chair.
Mr. Bradbury.
As you noted earlier, you do choose your words very carefefully in this setting.
I certainly try.
I did note earlier in your opening statement that you did take a swipe at Westpac, and in relation to that, I wonder, and that
did
was
I?
In the context of the rates, mortgage rates that they're charging and the extent to which they've increase those rates.
I'm not issuing a criticism of Westpac. I'm just noting that I think, if my memory is correct, those mortgage rates have risen by 98 points.
There's a need for counselling.
So if you are a customer of that bank, you've had the equivalent of four Reserve Bank tightenings, not three.
Thanks for reminding me.
If you're a customer of some other banks, it's three and a bit, but that's a fact. That's a fact we took account of in recent decisions.
It's a fact that you highlighted, and I'm wondering whether
it's relevant to the decisions we make, because we're noticing that, as I say, the rates people pay are moving a little bit more than the rate we are setting.
Yeah. And it's clearly a matter that is of great interest to all of us as elected representatives. My question goes to whether or not, in singling them out, you are, in fact,
no.
reflecting upon the extent to which they're contributing to competitive pressure within the sector.
No, I'm not seeking to single them out about competitive issues at all. They took their decision. The other banks all took their decisions. And actually, the fact that they all chose slightly different answers says that there are, at the margins, certain competitive dynamics at work between them, I think.
Okay. In terms of the stimulus, you've acknowledged today and previously you've acknowledged the impact of the stimulus in assisting Australia to avoid slipping into a technical recession. On this question of a technical recession, I wonder whether or not you'd be able to offer some comments as to how significant you think it was for the country to avoid slipping into technical recession. I know that Treasury noted that consumer confidence in the months after that data indicated that we didn't slip into a technical recession, that the data was at its strongest levels ever. Do you think that the mere fact that we avoided a technical recession of itself has been a factor that has contributed to buoyancy within the economy in Australia?
I think the fact that at a certain point, having had the single fall in GDP for one quarter and the next quarter being a positive, and so there was an avoidance of, as you put it, a technical recession, I think that fact probably does have a short-term boost to the next time the consumer confidence is measured. My guess is that by the next time it's measured, there's some other thing that's moving it around. But I think the more general point is that it has done a lot for confidence, as it should, that our country managed to avoid a very deep downturn when most other countries in the world had one. Many other, developed countries had one. That, I think, has done a lot for not just a sort of monthly index of confidence, but for our genuine sense of confidence about our future. I think that's appropriate that we have that reaction, provided that we are realistic in drawing the right lessons from this episode, which I think are the ones as I outlined a few minutes ago.
You mentioned in your opening statement that consumer confidence, consumer expenditure is unlikely to be the leading driver of growth that it once was. I wonder if you might be able to comment on what you see as being the leading drivers in the absence of consumer expenditure.
Well, it's not that consumers won't play any role, but I think, you know, we were in a period for some years where globally strong consumption, falling saving rates, gearing up by households was pushing economies along, including ours. Now, we probably stopped doing that to quite the same extent a little earlier, actually, than some others. Why? Because the resource sector build-up started to take on more prominence. That was already beginning in the period leading up to the global financial crisis. There was a sort of temporary loss of confidence there for a little while, but that confidence is back now. And the period we're going into, it would appear, as best we can see, involves very substantial resource sector investment with all the... that will be a driver of demand. We're also seeing, of course, a housing upswing at the moment, which we need. We need more houses built. So that's going to be a leading driver in the next year or two, I think. But if you're looking at a sort of a five-year horizon and asking, you know, what are the big picture things that are important in this economy? Well, I would have said terms of trade very high, very large intended build-up in resource sector investment, a lot of which is getting underway, with a lot of adjustment issues that will bring. That's going to be quite a powerful driver.
Can I also ask a question on the wholesale guarantee?
Yeah.
I note that there has been some criticism of the announced decision to phase out that guarantee. I wonder if you could express your view or the bank's view in relation to whether or not the timing of that phase down is appropriate.
I'm not sure where the criticism you're referring to is coming from. I think the decision was a good one. We recommended it on the Council of Financial Regulators. It's quite apparent that availability of funding for banks generally around the world has been improving for some time. The United States ended their guarantee in October. Some other countries ended in December, I think. Some other countries extended a bit but announced impending end dates. One or two other countries extended a little bit but made it harder to get. Our banks were only using it mainly opportunistically, for the majors certainly. They didn't actually need it. And I think it is better to, when conditions allow, to get back to a world where private markets price private risk and where banks do not rely on government guarantees for funding. We have to do that at some point. I don't think we want to be in a world where the government's guaranteeing everything indefinitely. That means you've got to get off at some time. And I think this was an appropriate time. After all, we are saying to everyone in the world, rightly, we've got among the world's best banks. We've come through the crisis better than most. Well, why would we need an ongoing guarantee when other countries are letting theirs go? I don't think we do need it, and so I think it was the right call, and I don't think it's, as far as I can see, caused any disruption.
I think there's a follow-up question from Mr. Bill.
Just on the guarantee issue, Governor, the retail bank guarantee, the issue around the arguments for and against some...
This is the million-dollar,
some permanency around that, yay or nay, but also it's had a profound and quite damaging impact on non-regulated investment vehicles and freezing redemptions on investor funds, and that's caused... quite a lot of hardship. Do you what do you think needs to be done to unlock those funds so people's savings in those funds can actually be redeemed?
People say that the guarantee forced a lot of troubles on those entities. That might be right. But wasn't there also a problem that some of these entities at least were kind of, offering to be like a bank deposit when they weren't really a bank deposit. And in a climate where there's a sudden rush to security, I have the suspicion myself that they were going to come under some strain anyway. Now, it may be that the announcement of the guarantee crystallised that, but possibly that's right. But, I'm not sure that you can really have, fundamentally, an entity that funds mortgages but offers overnight liquidity unless it's run like a bank, unless it really is a bank. So, I think there maybe was a bit of a problem there that people hadn't sort of fully understood until the crisis events occurred. What should happen from here? Well, the $1 million free guarantee is due to be reviewed by, I think it's October 2011. So there's time to do that, in my opinion. Personally, and I can't speak for other regulatory agencies here, APRA or the Treasury or anybody, but personally I think that that number ought to be lower once it's all reviewed, considerably lower. And I think that we ought to move to a system where it's a bit clearer what the sort of genuine deposit arrangements really are, and have a lower limit than that. I mean, it's a very generous limit. It worked well, but, I think the next most generous that I'm aware of is $250,000 in US dollars in the United States, and in Europe it's more like 100,000 euros. So ours is, by international standards, very generous. It's okay for the moment, but I think when we restructure all this in the final analysis, that number should be considerably lower than that.
And the frozen redemptions, do you see the spread of that guarantee, its duration and scale? That's one issue, but in terms of...
I'm not sure whether if that guarantee was suddenly removed, people are going to flock back to the mortgage trusts and others. I don't know, but I think maybe for some time people might take a slightly more cautious attitude to those products, really.
Okay. We're going to try and get another question if we can from everyone, but okay. Mr. Briggs has to leave early, so let Mr. Briggs go first.
Thank you, Chair. Lessons from, we've been talking about lessons from the crisis and lessons going forward. I'm interested in your thoughts on a potential issue which I think has some way to be debated yet. You've commented in recently about the increasingly complex environment that you operate in setting monetary policy, and it's more difficult now than it has been in the past because of the interconnections globally and so forth. You also commented in the Feb 9 publication about your independence, and I'm quoting you, say, hence independence comes with accountability and a higher requirement for transparency in the form of published reports and analysis, open parliamentary scrutiny, publications of minutes and so on.
Mm.
Do you think that it's time to look at the makeup of your board, given the complex nature of the environment you're operating in? Do you see a need, as Professor Adrian Pagan has argued, that for more expertise to be on that board? You know, it's good to have business leaders on there, but you engage regularly, Governor, with business leaders, I'm sure. And you get that advice from them. Do you think it would be useful, given the independent operations of the bank and the, you know, that...
I'm a bit reluctant to open up that line of discussion very much, I guess. It's not my prerogative to set the structure of the board. This board, there's an interesting history here. In 1945, when the central bank was the Commonwealth Bank, the board was actually abolished. Actually the same legislation, I think, that gave us the charter that we still have, abolished the board, and in effect left all the power in the hands of the governor. It was then reconstituted in 1951, and the board we have now is the same board, same mix of internal, external members. Secretary of the Treasury is a member, governor's chairman, and so on.
Mm.
So we've had it, this sort of a board, for 60 years almost. I know that Adrian made those remarks. But on the other hand, I think one would have to say a couple of other things. Firstly, this structure seems to have been working okay, pretty well, I would say, in recent years, if we judge by the results.
And the environment's other thing, changing, though. I mean, you've commented.
Yeah, and the other thing
changed.
I'd say is I think this board...
You want Paddy on the board?
In Australian society, at least hitherto, a board made up of men and women from commerce and academia and the general community, and not just made up of officials and monetary experts, I think probably has given us more legitimacy with our general man and woman in the street than we might otherwise have had. And that's an important thing to have.
Mm.
That doesn't mean that, you know, it's necessarily ideal forever, but... I mean, you're asking me, I'm the chairman of this board, you know, I defend it, I think it works well. It's very hard for me to engage in speculation about what might be better. It's certainly a unique board among developed country central banks. I can't think of any others that have our structure other than ones who copied it from us. There's a few in our neighbourhood that did. But, you know, it's worked.
Thank you.
Governor, I have a question in relation to productivity growth. This committee is also conducting at the moment an inquiry into productivity growth, and interested in your views on the role of macroeconomic policy in securing long-term productivity growth, and what part does monetary policy play in supporting a revitalised productivity growth cycle?
Well, If you don't mind, Mr. Chairman, I might pass to Phil on this one, some of those issues anyway.
Well, obviously it's incredibly important over the long run as a determinant of our average living standards. It's the only way we can increase those on a sustainable basis is to have strong productivity growth. But our role in this is fairly limited. I mean, what we can do for the community is to make sure that we deliver low and stable inflation so that people in the business community can make the right decisions. If you look back through economic history, if you have high and variable inflation, resource allocation in the private economy tends to get screwed up and you end up with lower levels of productivity growth and lower living standards. So what we can do for the community, what we can do for productivity growth is deliver low and stable inflation. Outside of that, we have very little influence, and it really comes down to the structural policies that governments put in place and the incentives of private business to innovate and to do things better. But that's really beyond our remit.
You've spoken, the Governor's spoken in the hearing today about the five-year outlook for commodities and the type of investment that's going into there. Clearly there are productivity issues there. I'm not sure if you want to make any comments in terms of that other than you've made already.
Over the next 5 or 6 years, we're going to see very significant increase in our resource exports. Mm. And there are various parts of the supply chain, in particular in coal, where there have been issues. Our understanding from talking to participants in those coal chains is that progress is being made. And we're seeing very, very high rates of investment, which are going to deliver, I think, in the next few years, quite high rates of increase in resource exports. So there have been issues. I think they're being addressed by these very high levels of investment. One issue that has been around for a while, and I think will be continue to be around, is that the recorded productivity growth in the mining sector is quite low at the moment. Mm. But the value added is quite high because the prices that the miners are getting are high. So we're getting, on the face of it, quite low productivity growth out of the mining sector. Mm. But the actual value added or the income that we're getting as a society is quite high. Mm. And so I think it's just a caution on interpreting the productivity data there, because the prices that we're getting are historically high. And that is allowing the mining companies to extract ores and coal and iron ore that is probably of lower standard than it otherwise would be, but the price is high, mm. and that ultimately helps our living standards.
Ms. Jackson.
Just perhaps picking up on some of those comments, because one of the things that's become clear to the committee is that the measurements of productivity aren't completely satisfactory, particularly in an economy now that has an increasing importance for the services sector, where there's limited factoring of that part of the sector into the economy. And, you know, from a personal point of view, I'm extremely concerned. There's a lot of work done in our economy that's not paid and therefore not counted in these sort of productivity measures. And I note the discussion earlier with Mr. Briggs about concerns about labour unit costs increasing. And I raise them because, you know, there's a substantial issue in my view about an underrepresentation of women in the workforce. It's clear that there's a substantial gender pay equity gap in existence in Australia, an average of 17%, in some industries as high as 35%. And I'd argue that that increase in wages costs, albeit not able to be broken down into labour unit costs, would be offset by a substantial increase in the participation of women in the labour force and therefore overall a national improvement in productivity. I guess I raise it because improvements in productivity are essential, I think, from what you've said, in ensuring that we continue to have recovery and an improved national economic position. But I don't want... I guess I'm saying there are some real question marks about the accuracy or the appropriateness of our current productivity measures. Would you agree?
Well, I think it's very difficult to measure productivity in the services sector. I'd agree with that. It's difficult to measure how it increases through time.
And that's a big issue if we're going to have a simplistic position that pressures on wages costs are necessarily always a bad thing, which I think your concern, Governor, was any increase in unit labour costs is not a good thing.
Well, what I said was in the scenario that was painted in the question, a rise in unit labour costs is a contributor to higher prices. That's inflation. That's not productivity because, if it's a unit cost, it's over and above productivity. As Phil says, it is very hard to measure productivity in general and especially in the services sector. But in the end, the test for us of wages and productivity and how it all falls out is what happens to prices, because that's our job to stabilise.
I think the only other observation I'd make here is that the least productive thing that a society can do is to have people sitting at home who want to work and who don't. So over the last 10 years, we've made tremendous progress in bringing people into employment who wanted jobs, and increasing labour supply of women is part of that story. So when you look at output per hour worked, it hasn't grown particularly strongly. But if you look at output per potential worker, it's grown reasonably strongly because we've been able to bring in to paid employment people who wanted to work and who couldn't. So I think at least to my mind, looking at output per head is only part of the story.
Yeah.
We've got to look at output per potential worker, and there the story's a bit different.
Ms. Lay.
Oh, just on the productivity, perhaps Dr. Lowe, just your comments on the link between our national savings and our future productivity growth, and in particular whether what you think the role of superannuation might be in contributing to that.
Well, in the end, the productivity growth is going to be driven by how much capital we put in place, how much investment we put in place, and how efficiently we use our capital and our labour. The superannuation is really about the financing of that. I think if we look forward, at least in our own forecast, we've got very high rates of investment returning in Australia. So that's going to mean the capital stock's going to rise quite quickly, and we're going to have to fund that. And superannuation is obviously going to be part of that. But I really see it's how much capital investment we do in the country and how efficiently we use that. They're the main determinants, and superannuation is part of the funding of that.
You don't feel we need a certain level to guarantee that contribution by superannuation?
No, I think the funding for the investment will come. Partly it will come through the superannuation funds, partly it will come from the banks using domestic savings, and partly it will come from foreign investment. But because the return on capital in Australia is high, we've got high investment, and I think we'll fund it. And it'll come from a variety of sources, and super will be one, but it will just be one.
Mr. Turner.
Yeah, my question goes to the issue of responses going forward. Acknowledging that it looks like unemployment has peaked in my own region, the regional unemployment figures were out yesterday, and if we look at the last 3 months, to be fair, in November it was 10.3 unemployment, December 10.6, and yesterday January's figures were out at 12.3, and seasonally unemployment generally does rise in Cairns because of the slowdown in the tourism industry. But clearly unemployment was around the 5 before the GFC, and it's significantly higher still than that. What is your data picking up, and how do you look at in terms of variations across the country in terms of responses that may be more optimistic in some parts of the country? Western Australia, I understand, is picking up with mining over there, and sections of maybe Queensland and New South Wales. And how do you take that into consideration in terms of your decision making on monetary policy?
Well, the figures we've got for Far North Queensland do look more or less as you say. in other parts of the country, they look considerably lower. I think we've come at this question in the past. We're not able to target or precisely manage the conditions for different parts of the country. We have only the one instrument. All we can do is to set what we think is the right level for the average. And I'd have to say, I think in most parts of the country, really at the moment, I fully accept that far north Queensland is an exception. And I'm not sure I can give you all the whys and wherefores why that is, but in most parts of the country, actually, unemployment's pretty low, which is good, of course. But I don't have a solution for the double-digit story up there. I'm sorry.
We are working. Just picking up on that, before there was a lot of talk about two-speed economy, West and Queensland. Yeah. Do you see any risks of that are developing further?
Yes. I think it is going to be a two-speed economy. I think, and I've said publicly, that I think all those issues of geographical differences and industry differences are likely to re-emerge with a vengeance. If we take as our predicating assumption that the story is that Asian and Chinese and so on demand for resources continues to be strong, that those parts of the world continue to grow, that our economy naturally will want to adjust to those changes in relative prices. That's how it presents to us. The relative price of resources is high, that of manufacturers is low. There are structural adjustment implications of this for our economy, and we've said this. We can't make the structural adjustment occur, actually, and we can't really make it any easier. But it's going to be prompted by, as we were talking about earlier, wages and conditions in some sectors will get higher because they want to attract the workers. Other sectors won't be able to match that. The people are going to move. The exchange rate's high. And so what that does is put pressure on import competitors, manufacturers and so on. And some of our demand for those products gets spilled abroad to cheaper areas. That's how the economy copes with these things. So the structural adjustment issues are there, and they will, I think, probably intensify in the years ahead if this scenario pans out. It may not, of course. Something else may go wrong. But I think those issues will be quite important ones. I'm not going to be able to provide you, though, with any answers as to how they won't go away unless the initiating set of forces in Asia goes away. So the economy will one way or another adjust to them, and the issue for policymakers and governments in particular is how to make that adjustment work easily and smoothly. I don't think you can really resist it.
Thank you. Mr. Bradbury. One more from Mr. Bilson.
You've talked a lot about the economic instruments and environment. One thing that I think doesn't get enough attention, and that's the software, the people. What's your take on entrepreneurship, these pressures on costs, the attractiveness of funds going into non-productive investments, the like risk aversion that's around? What do you see as the future for, particularly with the young audience here, the encouragement for entrepreneurship and innovation?
Well, I would hope that young entrepreneurs would maintain their optimism. We talked earlier about what a boost to confidence it was that we didn't really have a big downturn. I think that is important. And I've said all through this episode that Australians have a lot of reasons to be confident about the future of our country. That we're up to the challenges we face if we just approach them sensibly. So I would hope that people would maintain that confidence. I think entrepreneurship's probably always been hard, hasn't it? Has it ever been easy to get capital for a start-up? I think most people who build a business from nothing probably have always mortgaged the house, scrimped and saved, I don't know. I mean, it's always been, I'm not saying that it should be, but it always has been, I suspect, that way. Is it any easier now? It isn't. But the kind of people who want to do that, I suspect, are the sort of people who probably won't be put off by the roadblocks and hurdles and so on that life throws up. That's my guess. And I would hope we could be confident in the future of that entrepreneurship here. And maybe work at recognising it.
Governor, we've got two more student questions to conclude today. And the first one's from Boyan Teskiski. Sorry about the pronunciation if I got that wrong. From Darra Mallon College, which I also admitted to say were here earlier. So apologies to the college.
Boyan.
Mr. Stevens, earlier you mentioned your prediction on growth. I would like to know how confident you are in this prediction and whether you considered consumer confidence, as this could be a volatile factor given it is an election year. No doubt we will be bombarded by messages from the media about doom and gloom, and many people will question whether they will still support the government. The media will play a big role in making consumers nervous, and so I'm still wondering, whether you will be confident in this prediction.
Well, I agree that consumer confidence can swing. I agree that the media can perhaps be prone to bombard us with doom and gloom. I think that's a constant. I think that's a new variable. There is... many business people would tell you that confidence... that people become more cautious in the lead-up to an election just because they don't know the outcome and then they wait. That happens every 3 years, so it's presumably something that we cope with and get over. So I don't think that everybody also knows that the election's going to be this year sometime, so it could be that some new event or twist or turn will damage confidence, but I have as much confidence in our forecast as I ever do, which my colleague is laughing because he knows that... I've made many forecasts in my life. I've seen many, many, many forecasts go wrong, so I have the appropriate degree of confidence in them. But, I think they're as reliable as they normally are, so that's as good as we can hope, I think. And I think we'll get by the election okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Boyan. The next question comes from Amanda Cross from Canberra Girls Grammar School.
Amanda. Hi, Amanda.
Mr. Stevens, the government and opposition climate change policies are to be funded very differently. Would you support either a market-driven or government-regulated model as have been outlined by the relevant parties? Which do you believe would be more sustainable for the Australian economy?
I'm going to duck this one. On the grounds that I just don't know enough about climate change policy to give an informed opinion, that's first. And second, the bank's job is mainly to keep its mouth shut on this matter.
You're being carbon neutral.
As on so many others. So I'm sorry, I can't choose between them for you today.
Thank you.